Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Noam Chomsky may be the world's most widely read super critic of American policy, but even his books got a boost in sales last month when Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez waved one on the floor of the UN General Assembly and implored gathered heads of state to read it. A boost as in number one on Amazon.com. Chomsky made his name as a brilliant scholar of linguistics, but for decades now he has been a brutal critic of American power and its uses. Admirers call him a hero. Critics call him a ranter. Chomsky just keeps writing. His latest message, as tough as ever, America itself is a failed state. Up next on Point, the super critic of American hyperpower, Noam Chomsky. Joining me now in the studio is Noam Chomsky. He's professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's the author of a long list of political treatises going back to the Vietnam era. The book that leapt to number one after the Chavez speech, published in 2003, is called Hegemony or Survival: America's Quest for Global Dominance. Chomsky's latest book, just out this summer, is Failed States, The Abuse of Power and the Assault on Democracy. Noam Chomsky, welcome.
Glad to be with you.
You jump right in on this book with a list of top priorities, yours anyway, top agenda items for the world, and right away America's tangled up in problems on your list. Give us your top list and where you see the U.S. sitting in the midst of it.
Well, I think at the top of anyone's list should be literal threats to survival of the species, which are real. The most severe of them, perhaps the most imminent, is the growing threat of nuclear war. People like former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara are not exaggerating when he speaks of apocalypse soon. Other leading analysts speak of ultimate doom, maybe not far away, if the current programs of aggressive militarism continue, with their obvious consequences, which are well understood and which we see, leading to an increasing threat of a nuclear confrontation, which could in fact be terminal. The other major threat to survival, and it's very real, is environmental catastrophe. It's not as imminent and not as instantly destructive, but it's something like that is probably coming. And the longer we delay to do anything about it, the worse it'll be.
So you say nuclear war threat number one, environmental catastrophe disaster number two, and number three, in your view, reading here in the opening of the book, goes right to the USA.
A third problem is that our own government is increasing these threats. In fact, is playing a significant role in increasing these threats. And a fourth related problem is that it's doing so over the opposition of the large majority of the population, overwhelming, in fact. So it takes as an example, just the Kyoto Protocol on global warming, which is a small step but a significant one. You read in the press that the United States opposed it almost alone, which is true only in a curious sense. If you mean by the United, if you intend the term United States not to include its population, it's true. If the United States includes its population, the United States overwhelmingly supported the treaty, in fact so strongly that a majority of Bush voters thought that he supported it.
So you see, Noam Chomsky, the world hurtling toward risks
any number, and there are many in this book, but nuclear war, environmental catastrophe, the world superpower pushing that along in opposition to its populace, the fact that it's an elected government in Washington that is promoting these policies doesn't mean anything to you?
Yeah, it means a lot. In fact, I talk about it a lot in the book. There has been one characteristic of failed states is that they may have democratic institutions, but they fail to function. And that's increasingly the case in the United States, unfortunately.
Failed state is the phrase you wrap around the United States. Many features of failed states now, and you say at the heart of it is a problem with the democracy itself. You write that the U.S. is headed in a direction that spells the end of its historic values of equality, liberty, and meaningful democracy. We'll look at that in more detail as well, but give us your failed state analysis. I mean, many people would say, well, here's the superpower, the hyperpower, the richest country that there's ever been. Noam Chomsky calls that a failed state. Why?
Well, as I discussed there, I'm just adopting the standard usage. The term failed states has nothing to do with strength or weakness. So Nazi Germany and Stalinist Russia and Saddam Hussein's Iraq are correctly considered to be failed states.
When I think of failed state, I think of Somalia or Afghanistan after the turmoil of the Soviet invasion, not necessarily a war machine like Nazi Germany.
Well, I'm using it in the standard sense, and I give many citations. Yes, it's independent of strength. There are all kind of ways to be a failed state.
So what are the features that you're seeing
in the
U.S.?
The major features, it's not a precise concept, but the way it's correctly used, I think. A failed state is one that is either unwilling or unable to protect its population from dangers, maybe even destruction. It's a state that openly announces it's what's called sometimes an outlaw state in the literature. It's a state that disregards international law and norms and does so quite openly and frankly. And as I said, may have democratic institutions, but they may be not functioning significantly.
The U.S. has its biggest military budget in history, but you would say it's unwilling or unable to protect its population. Make sense
exactly.
of that for us.
That military budget is, first of all, in opposition to the popular will. If you look at my review there, some of the polls on what people think the budget ought to be, it's almost the opposite of what it is. So it's in the first place, it is an indication of the increasing and dangerous gap between public opinion and public policy. But also it's that military budget that is increasing threats to Americans and, in fact, to the world. So it is playing a significant role in the expansion of aggressive militarism that is exactly as predicted, inducing potential adversaries to increase their offensive military capacity.
Are you asserting the opposite then? If the U.S. would crank down its military spending or disarm, that the rest of the world would do the same?
It shouldn't disarm, but the United States is driving the increasing development of what the rest of the world, others regard as deterrent to potential U.S. attack. That means offensive, the Russians have sharply increased offensive military spending and development in reaction to the escalating Bush budget, armaments budget and threats. Chinese beginning to do the same. Others are developing their own forms of deterrence. There are only two forms. One is nuclear weapons, the other is terror. The United States is, in fact, acting in ways which increase the threat of terror to the United States.
Outlaw nation. You pin this on the U.S. Of course, Washington would pin that, has pinned it on Saddam Hussein's Iraq, maybe on Iran now with its nuclear developments, on lots of others, not on itself.
Well, yes, but Nazi Germany didn't describe itself as an outlaw state either, and I'm not making that analogy. But, in fact, no one describes themselves that way. The question is what they're doing. Saddam Hussein's Iraq was certainly an outlaw state. So, for example, its invasion of Iran was a pure act of aggression, which led to the killing of hundreds of thousands of people, tens of thousands of Iranians were killed by chemical weapons, all sorts of atrocities, and the U.S. participated in it.
So you're not saying this started with George W. Bush. You've got a case that goes much deeper here. Certainly waxed Bill Clinton along the way.
Well, it goes all the way back. In fact, one of the things I discuss in the book is one of the leading American historians, John Lewis Gaddis, wrote a scholarly book, the first scholarly book, tracing what he called the roots of the Bush Doctrine, of which he basically approves. And he traced it back to his intellectual hero, John Quincy Adams, and Adams's justification for the invasion of Florida in 1818.
You turn out to be a hero of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. 2 weeks ago, Hugo Chavez stood at the podium during the General Assembly at the United Nations, and he began his speech to the gathered heads of state, foreign ministers, and ambassadors, holding aloft a copy of Noam Chomsky's 2003 book, Hegemony or Survival.
Quiero invitarles con mucho respeto.
I would like to invite you, very respectfully, to those who have not read this book, to read it. Noam Chomsky, one of the most prestigious American and world intellectuals, and this is one of his most recent books, Hegemony or Survival, The Imperialist Strategy of the United States. It's an excellent book to help us understand what has been happening in the world throughout the 20th century and what's happening now and the greatest threat looming over our planet, the hegemonistic pretensions of the American Empire are placing at risk the very survival of the human species.
After that speech, Hegemony or Survival shot to first place on Amazon.com. Noam Chomsky's new book is Failed States. Noam Chomsky, do you find yourself in agreement with Hugo Chavez there, the American Empire placing at risk the very survival of the human species? It sounds as though you do.
Yeah, of course. I've been writing about it for a long time.
What did you think of that moment? You must have seen it replayed later. He's waving your book. He's entreating the world to read Noam Chomsky and then calling George Bush the devil. What did you think of the whole performance?
Well, actually, I didn't see it, and I don't care much about it. What I did care about, and I think we should all care about, is what he said. He gave a talk at the Security Council. It's his most important address, of course. And the address in the Security Council, I saw no reference to it, but it was a serious address which raised important points that we ought to think about. Even at the address of the General Assembly, which was less important, where there was the inflammatory rhetoric that you mentioned, there were other questions to raise. For example, if you look at the New York Times coverage of it, which focused on the inflammatory rhetoric and actually what turned out to be an invention, namely that he had this claim that he said he'd wanted to meet me, but was sorry that I had died. He was referring very explicitly and unambiguously to John Kenneth Galbraith, unambiguously. So put that aside. But those are the two things that captured the media eye. The one thing I would question what you're saying is the phrase hypercritic that you've used. Actually, my views on these things are pretty much in the mainstream. So my views on the role of U.S. power in raising the risk, in fact, sharply raising the risk of apocalypse soon, that comes straight from the most respectable sources. People like Robert McNamara, the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, other strategic analysts, and so on. My views on policy happen to be pretty close to those of, on many issues, of the large majority of the population.
So there are a lot of thinkers out there who share pieces of the Chomsky analysis, and you're looking at polls and finding support there as well. But I've got to say, I don't read anybody who rolls it together in quite the same way that you do, Noam Chomsky, with the sort of soup to nuts lambasting that comes off the Chomsky keyboard. At the end of the day, are you hoping for the United States to fail? Is it that big a threat?
Of course not. What I'm worried about is that, as you said before, is taking on some of the characteristics of failed states. That's a serious problem for us and for the world, given U.S. power. There's a reason, after all, why, if you take a look at international polls, most recent have just come out in the last few weeks, even in Europe, which is the region most supportive of the United States is ranked highest as a threat to world peace among all the states that are listed, far higher than Iran, far, far higher than Russia and China and so on. That should concern us very much.
You say the American system itself is in deep trouble, and I guess that's why, in your view, it's not producing the policies that you'd like to see, and maybe others as well. What's the problem with the system as you interpret it?
Well, there are a number of problems.
Let's corporatized state capitalist democracy.
Yeah. One of the things that's happened in the last several decades, increasingly, it's happening elsewhere too, but more strikingly here, is that the political system is being eroded of content. So take, say, the last election, which I go through. There were two candidates, born to wealth and power. They went to the same elite university, joined the same secret society where you train people to run the world, were able to run in the election because they are funded by pretty similar sectors of private power. There was an election, so-called, run by the public relations industry, committed to focusing on what are called qualities or images, not issues. Issues are pretty much off the agenda. Most of the population didn't even know where the candidates stood on issues. In fact, increasingly, the elections resemble television ads. If you look at a television ad for, say, an automobile, you don't expect to find information. You expect to be deluded by imagery, contrary to what's often claimed. There is a theory of markets, abstract theory, that says that they're based on informed consumers making rational choices. We all know that business spends huge sums to try to create uninformed consumers making irrational choices.
So what's the mastermind? If that's what's going on, what's the motive, what's the mastermind behind the American direction in the Chomsky interpretation?
As I quote Adam Smith, it's just an extension of what Adam Smith pointed out over two centuries ago. He was talking about England. He said the principal architects of policy in his day, the merchants and manufacturers, make sure that their own interests are very carefully attended to, however grievous the impact on others, including their own population.
How can it be in the interest of any American sector, including merchants and manufacturers, capitalists, for the United States to be a failed state if they looked at it your way?
Actually, nowadays it's not Smith's merchants and manufacturers, it's multinational corporations, financial institutions.
Even
so
there,
on.
I mean, let's say for a moment that they look in and they say, you know, we've got some real problems here. Yeah, let's drive further off this cliff. I mean, if you're right, are they that blind?
It's not blind. Furthermore, first of all, in the case of the Bush administration, which is extreme, I mean, there is a tradition. Gaddis is correct when he traces this back. He traces it back with praise. I trace it back with criticism, but it's the same discussion to the early days. Yes, there's a background, but the Bush administration is extreme. It's a extreme, radical, statist, reactionary system.
But why would the powers that be, look at the people, but the power for a minute, why would it want to drive off a cliff?
They're split. In fact, there is unprecedented criticism of the Bush administration right within the mainstream. So take this notion of imperial power that you quoted from the subtitle of Hegemony or Survival. Mm. Actually, that wasn't mine. That was taken from the main establishment journal, Foreign Affairs, in an article by a very respected conservative American historian, John Eikenberry, right after the announcement of the so-called Bush Doctrine in September 2002.
I get that, but I'm flummoxed by why this all-powerful kind of multinational driver that you see behind things would want to drive off a cliff, if that's what's happening, if you're right.
There's a lot of criticism, and there's a split. There's an internal split, and the Bush administration has succeeded with a very narrow hold on political power. It has succeeded in driving policy way off the center. Actually, there's a very good book on this, which I didn't have, came out later than I could quote, by two well-known political scientists, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson, called Off-Center, which discusses how the techniques by which they have succeeded in creating a highly authoritarian state controlling driving policy far beyond certainly what the population wants, but even what major sectors of power want.
Are the people that weak and major centers of power that weak? I mean, if they really accept or sort of second your view of the world, why aren't there riots in the street? Are you perhaps misreading the American people?
Well, the only reading I can do is from the detailed studies of public opinion that are carried out. And, of course, we all have personal experience, and I have quite a lot. But I don't rely on that. I travel all over the country and so on. But I don't rely on that. What I rely on is very careful, detailed studies of public opinion and the way in which the system is operating, in which my views are not unusual. For example, Hacker and Pearson give an even more detailed analysis of it than I did. I just gave a little bit of it. But yes, these things are happening. There's unprecedented criticism. On the other hand, the business world is euphoric about the Bush administration programs. It is pouring money into the pockets of the very rich, even more so than in the past.
But the rich would roast in a nuclear explosion as well, or in a global warming, so I still don't get why they would sign on, if you're right, to what you see as a kind of doomsday scenario.
Well, then you have to, ask the chair of ExxonMobil why they are funding heavily a few maverick scientists who raise questions about the overwhelming consensus that we're moving on to economic catastrophe. Mm-hmm. And I think I know the answer they'll give. The actual answer, which they won't give, is it's increasing sharply their profit and power today. The answer they will give is, well, we're not sure, and then come the excuses that you've read and so on. And the same is true of nuclear power. Mm. I mean, if you look at the community of strategic analysts, people who really pay attention to this. I give a lot of quotes, but they're right from the mainstream. They are deeply concerned.
Noam Chomsky, towering critic, says he's just one of the guys. I want to turn to our listeners. Priscilla is calling from Jewett City, Connecticut. Hi, Priscilla. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello. Good morning, Mr. Chomsky.
Good morning.
You're talking a lot about perception and people being blind and a lot about the rich. Why they are so willing to go along and line their pockets with this. I believe that they believe that they're immune. I know that a lot of times people, they're so insulated. They believe that when this happens that there will be a place for them to go where they're not going to be affected by it. Well, guess what? There's nowhere to go. And another aspect about people perhaps being blind to some of what's going on. Are you there?
Yep. Yes, we're right here, Priscilla.
People being blind to what's going on, I don't think people are blind. I think people do realize. But if you really want to get an idea about how other countries feel about us, people don't have the opportunity to travel. Now, I have family members that have traveled to different countries. They've been to Russia, Spain, Italy, a lot of different countries. And one thing that they have encountered is what you're talking about is out and out people coming up to them and finding out that they're American and commenting on our government and Bush in particular. My mother went to Spain. My sister's been to Russia. This woman in Russia came up to my sister and explained to her in the few words that she knew how to speak in English that she thought Bush was the fastest, and why did my sister vote for this man?
Priscilla, we've got it. Your mom hearing an echo around the world, and you feeling it as well. I thank you for calling us. I want to invite another voice into this conversation, if I may. Joining us from New York, Alan Dershowitz, a professor of law at Harvard Law School, a vocal critic of Noam Chomsky. Alan Dershowitz, thanks for being with us. Noam Chomsky says we've got a failed state underway here. It's a threat to the planet. And you hear a listener right there saying, you know what, I'm worried that's true. How do you read it, Alan Dershowitz?
Well, I'm worried, too, about America. I'm certainly worried about the Bush administration, but I think that Noam paints with far too broad a brush and too little nuance. I think he sees things in black and white terms. We are an imperfect democracy, but the problems in the world are caused by perfect tyrannies like North Korea and the Sudan, where genocide is going on, and other parts of Africa, and in Iran. And I think to focus only on America's imperfections, which are there, to be sure, clearly there is anti-Bush sentiment all over the world. Not, by the way, all over the world. In India, by the way, according to recent polls, American standing is very, very high for reasons that probably have to do with American and Indian economic relationships. The other important point is that still all immigrants in the world want to come to America, and very, very few who come ever leave here. People do vote with their feet, and it's a mixed picture, and I'm very critical of many parts of America, too, but I think when you overstate it in this way, and when you see almost no virtue and no effort to make the country a better country, then I think the criticism begins to get blunted. For example, Noam has said over the years that virtually every American president since Roosevelt would be hanged at Nuremberg under Nuremberg principles. He happens to be speaking today at the during the Bush administration when a lot of people support him. I'm among them. I support a lot of what he says about the Bush administration. But if he had made the same statements 10 years ago during the Clinton administration, and he made similar statements 10 years ago, there'd be far less support. So I think it's very important to distinguish between a particular administration and America since John Quincy Adams. That's, again, a typical overstatement. We are an imperfect democracy that has struggled very hard. We have been beloved around the world. We have been hated around the world. I think we have to improve. I think Chomsky is an important figure in helping pointing out our errors, and I wish he would be more nuanced, and I think his impact would be far greater than it is today because he does not represent the mainstream.
Noam Chomsky, Alan Dershowitz says, asks, why do you focus your fire on an imperfect democracy rather than imperfect tyrannies?
Oh, I certainly don't. I agree with everything you said, and in fact, I not only see an effort to make the country better, but write about it and participate in it. And I think, and I discuss ways in which people do, in fact, I spent a lot of time discussing ways in which people have made it a much better country.
Every president since Roosevelt could have been hanged at Nuremberg. That's a pretty sweeping condemnation.
And I give the reasons for it.
But it doesn't leave a lot of room for working with American reality, right?
Well, yes,
those
it
are
does.
Elected
yes,
presidents.
Yes, it does. It says that we should pay attention to the fact that we should, for example, look at the words of Justice Robert Jackson, the U.S. counsel at Nuremberg, chief counsel, who said at the end of the proceedings that we are handing the defendants a poison chalice, and if we sip from it, we should face the same consequences. Otherwise, it is meaningless. And if you look, I can't run through it here, but I've done it in response to questions mostly for a long time. These are all responses to questions. I said, well, let's go through the record. And I go case by case and show that, yes, including Clinton, there are actions of the kind for which we did hang people at Nuremberg. Why do I focus on the United States? Very simple reason. First of all, I don't ignore the other tyrannies. I talk about them all the time, but the real tyrannies. But I focus on the United States because it happens to be our country.
Alan Dershowitz, I've just got you for half a minute more. Net benefit to having Noam Chomsky's big brain focused on this country, a net plus?
Well, I think it's a net plus, but I think it could be a much greater net plus if he focused as much attention on genocides that are going around the world. You know, Chomsky missed the boat on Cambodia. He has not been a strong voice on Darfur and the Sudan.
Alan Dershowitz, thanks for being with us. Noam Chomsky, what do you say?
Well, first, I quite agree with Mr. Dershowitz that we should not overstate. We should state things accurately. And if he can ever find an example in the many pages he's written about this, I'd like to see it. The two examples he mentioned are simply false and easily demonstrable to be false. With regard to Cambodia, the position that I took happened to be pretty much that of State Department intelligence, namely hideous atrocities, but we should tell the truth about them, not fabricate in the interests of state power. In the case of Darfur,
this is the charge that you were kind of on board with the Khmer Rouge.
Yeah, I was taking the position of, in fact, I was probably one of the only people who quoted State Department intelligence analysts who turned out in retrospect to have been correct and said, yes, let's talk about the atrocities. Let's try to do something to stop them. I bitterly condemned the United States policy of supporting the Khmer Rouge and condemning Vietnam for terminating their atrocities. And so it continues.
I have no doubt Alan Dershowitz would have plenty to say.
If anybody can find anything, I would agree with his point. We should not overstate. With regard to Darfur, What I've said and will say again is it's one of the terrible atrocities. They're worse, like Eastern Congo happens to be much worse. But this is a very bad one. We should do something about it. I've suggested what I think we ought to do at the very minimum, provide logistic and humanitarian support for an expanded African force there. Beyond that, I would support any proposal if any had been made. But if you look, every proposal, at least that I've seen, is grandstanding. It's, let's you do something about it.
Mary's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. You know, Professor Chomsky is right on time, and he already answered part of my question. I was interested in comparing America to Germany in the 1930s, but I wish he would go into 1933 when Goebbels, and 1934 when Goebbels took over the media. This is why there's no so-called public opinion, and compare the industrialists to our multinationalists, because our multinationals have no home, so they're not worried about America, and how Hitler fired Yamash Schaff as president of the Reichsbank because of the military budget, and Schaff said that it was going to lead to inflation. If you notice, everything is going up and up, but our incomes are static. And Chavez did a wonderful thing. He did a Richard Pryor act to hold America, a mirror up to America, of how we really are.
Mary, we've got it. Noam Chomsky, she's got a...
Well, her point is, I understand it and have some sympathy for it. There is some reason for paying attention to what happened in Germany in the 1930s. Actually, again, I discuss it in the book, not in my words, but referring again to an article in Foreign Affairs by a leading German historian, Fritz Stern, who drew the comparison. What happened in Germany should be a warning to us. Germany was the peak of Western civilization. It was not a barbarian state. The Weimar...
The flower of music, great scholarship.
Yeah, science, the arts. It was the peak of Western civilization. Within a few years, it had been turned into a country of raving savages and carried out maybe the worst atrocities in world history.
Do you see the United States on a similar path?
No, but I do endorse the comments of Fritz Stern, who I quoted in Foreign Affairs, a famous German historian. He began by saying that he himself had been a refugee from Germany. He was welcomed by this country. He thanks the country for welcoming him, allowing him to pursue a distinguished career. And then he says, I fear for the future of my adopted country. And then he begins to review what happened in those hideous years in Germany, quoting statements which are practically taken from contemporary political rhetoric here, which is what he means. So sure, it's not happening. We're probably the freest country in the world, as repeated again. But we can give up that legacy of freedom, and we have to be careful not to do it. Now, if that's an overstatement, I'd like to hear why.
Let me take a call from Somerville, Massachusetts. Chaim is on the line. Hi, Chaim. You're on the air.
Hi. First, I want to thank you for breaking the Chomsky barrier on major media outlets.
We listen to everybody here, Chaim. What's your question for Noam Chomsky?
It's been a long time, but you are now, so thanks. Professor Chomsky, I'm sure you know many of your critics and also many of your supporters consider you a conspiracy theorist or an analyst of ruling conspiracies. Listeners to this program, to your comments on this program, could take much of what you said about how decisions get made and policies get formulated and in whose interest as a description of the ruling conspiracy of this country. I know that, in fact, you reject conspiracy theorizing, and I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about how your view differs from that, and I'll take your answer off the air.
Noam Chomsky.
Well, it's kind of ironic because one of the harshest criticisms that I get, I'm sure there'll be half a dozen letters in tonight's email, is that I oppose conspiracy theories. I could go into that. But the what is described as a conspiracy theory is pretty much what I quoted from Adam Smith, who was not a conspiracy theorist. He was describing the institutional structure of England, his concern, and the way in which policies are made in the interests of its principal architects, who happen to be the concentrations of economic power that he was describing.
That's not a conspiracy?
It's not a conspiracy.
It's just a market dynamic?
It's just the normal working of institutions.
Is capitalism itself a conspiracy then, in effect?
First of all, we don't have capitalism, but there are...
Well, we sure don't have socialism.
No, we have a kind of state capitalism with very heavy reliance on the dynamic state sector of the economy for innovation and development and so on. It's a kind of a mixed system like most countries. But it's not a conspiracy. It's an array of institutions which concentrate power very narrowly. It's not a great secret that economic power and decision-making power are very narrowly concentrated, and we can identify the places where they're concentrated, you know, if you want details.
But the policies are not deliberate, you're suggesting.
Of course the policies are deliberate.
Well, what's the difference between that and a conspiracy?
Was England a conspiracy when Adam Smith pointed out that the merchants and manufacturers design policy in their own interest?
It's just people pursuing self-interest.
It's people. It's power centered. Not even in people, because they're in institutions.
Well, they're people.
But look, if you're the CEO of a major corporation, you are bound by law to pursue certain objectives. It's a core principle of Anglo-American corporate law that the directors of corporations must pursue profit and market share.
Do you really believe American corporations, America, will follow those interests right off a cliff?
Of course not. In fact, it's changed.
You seem to be warning exactly that. We're on the way to nuclear war, environmental catastrophe.
Yeah, we're doing it. But in the past...
Where's the break?
Exactly what I discuss. In the past, for hundreds of years, there have been popular struggles which have increased freedom, justice,
But you're citing poll numbers, not a popular struggle. There's a difference, isn't there?
Throughout American history, there have been such struggles. There have been periods of quiescence. Then the struggles began again. And I think we're ripe for it once again. Let's just take our own recent history. The 1950s were a period of extreme passivity. Also, religious revivalism, extreme religious revivalism. There was talk at the end of the 50s about how ideology's dead, conflict's dead, everyone agrees.
Then came the 1960s, and it civilized the country.
I mean, very much civilized it. Women's rights, minority rights, opposition to aggression, concern over the environment. These are all civilizing factors. It created a much better country.
So the weather can change, says Noam Chomsky. I want to go to London for just a moment. We heard from Alan Dershowitz, who's quite a big critic. Let's hear from a voice of a supporter. Pat Kane is with us, a writer and journalist, author of The Play Ethic. He's written about Chomsky, interviewed him at length for the BBC in the 1990s. Maybe a voice representing Chomsky's enormous popularity around the world. Pat Kane, what do you find so good about Noam Chomsky?
Well, I think the thing about Noam Chomsky is, I think so many people are supporters of him on this side of the water, precisely because he embodies those kind of British and maybe I might even say Scottish Enlightenment values that he's been invoking in your conversation so far. I mean, I've counted three mentions of Adam Smith already. And I think Noam Chomsky fits in very well with the tenor of a certain element of left liberal culture in the UK, represented by journalists like John Pilger and Robert Fisk. But you kind of got a flavor of it in America when George Galloway came over to the subcommittee of the Senate and lambasted your nation for its crimes. Chomsky here is kind of part of a mainstream of discussion about the effects of power, not just American power, but of course, as Chomsky will often say, the spear carriers of the UK and of the Blair government in relation to American power.
Pat, speak to the way he's celebrated in your country. I mean, in the U.S., he publishes plenty of books here, but the public celebration of Noam Chomsky, you'd have to say, very low level here compared to some settings abroad. Have you seen the difference?
Well, I'll give you a tangible example of the difference. There's a very sort of mainstream centrist magazine called Prospect, which is a bit like New Republic, or it's a very mainstream. They had a vote actually tying together with Foreign Policy magazine, the American journal, to find out the top intellectual in the world. And much, I think, to many people's embarrassment, within the magazine, Noam Chomsky was voted number one, and I think it was voted number one Also, I think because people recognize that as a linguist, although I think Noam, and certainly in my interview, he didn't like to make the connection between his linguistics and his politics, but I think people do intuit that the kind of the idea of language being something that everyone innately has, you know, without hierarchy, without people being more or less equal, we all have it, is tied to his vision of democracy, or radical democracy, or every institution of power having to justify itself in the face of those that it rules over, absolutely without quarter.
Looking for deep structure in both streams there. Pat Kane, we've got so many listeners at this side of the Atlantic who want to talk with Noam Chomsky. Thanks for being with us from London.
Sure.
If I can just make one comment.
Yes,
you're absolutely right in bringing out the role of the Scottish Enlightenment in my own thought, also in my work on language, philosophy, cognitive science. I think it's one of the 18th century Scottish Enlightenment is one of the peaks of Western civilization.
Pat, thanks for being with us. Let's turn to Chicago. Davis is on the line. Hi, Davis. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning, and thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think, Davis?
Okay, so this is what I think. I'm wondering if the thing that Thomas Friedman describes as the flattening of the world, you know, globalization and all this, is it making it difficult for governments to convince their people that an active role in politics is where they're going to really contribute to society?
Now, why would it have that effect, Davis? Globalization.
Because I think that the internet and sort of this place where there's low barriers to entry and people can go on and create a change in society, so with more focus on themselves and have more power to actually just make a contribution. I think voter turnout can be cited, you know, to sort of show my point, given that, you know, Abraham Lincoln's time, there's 85% turnout, now it's like 30%. Maybe governments just are not where it's at, and they're sort of struggling to suck sort of the last bits of power and money out before the truly global age of the internet, you know, emerges.
Davis, let us pick it up. Noam Chomsky, that intersection, globalization, the web, Tom Friedman's flat earth. More democratic power in this realm or less?
Well, the world is not getting flatter. On the contrary, take our own country, has the highest level of inequality it's had since probably the 1920s, maybe before, and there are similar things elsewhere. What's called globalization is a particular form of international integration, which is committed primarily to rights of investors and lenders. Most of the population of the world, including the United States, is against that particular form of globalization and prefers other forms which would privilege the rights of people, not concentrations of private power. And in fact, globalization, so-called globalization, is having the effect of increasing the level of popular activism and political activism. One of the most striking examples, maybe the most lively part of the world right now, is South America. I mean, from all the way through the continent.
Your pal Hugo's turf.
He's part of it, but it goes down to Argentina, Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador. There'll be an election in a couple of weeks. All over Brazil, there has been a huge popular reaction against the particular form of investor rights globalization. Huge popular. And in fact, it's reaching the North, too.
Davis, thanks for your call. Noam Chomsky, our time grows short. You say this in the book. You say reforms will not suffice. Fundamental social change is necessary to bring meaningful democracy. You say your mainstream guide sounds like a call for revolution. What kind of fundamental reform?
Can I see the context just to make sure what I'm referring to? I'm quoting John Dewey. I'm quoting the leading American social philosopher of the 20th
century.
You're
endorsing. So what do you mean, fundamental social change, not reform?
Exactly what John Dewey said, and I quote it there. He's right out of mainstream America.
What do you mean by it?
Exactly what he meant. What he talked about and what I quote there, he pointed out that, in his words, politics is the shadow cast by big business over society.
So out and with big business, out with business. Are you
exactly what he said, and I quote it and go on. Namely, he said, until we replace industrial feudalism by industrial democracy, politics will remain the shadow. By industrial democracy, he meant what working people in the United States fought for in the 19th century and often still do, that there should be democratic control of economic institutions as well as political institutions.
Is that ever going to happen in this country?
Well, you know, it came pretty close in the 19th century, and yes, I think it can happen again. I think Dewey had a lot to say. And remember, he's not a marginal character. He is the leading U.S. social and political philosopher right in out of Main Street.
Right out of Main Street, Noam Chomsky says, Professor Chomsky, the new book is Failed States, The Abuse of Power and the Assault on Democracy. Noam Chomsky, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.